Okay, so she earlier asked, could a person with an annual income of 350,000, 3.5 million yen, start on residential investment? Otherwise, what other areas can we work on to get there?
That'll be an Emil question.
Sorry, can you give me those numbers one more time?
Yeah, the specific number that she used was 350,000 annual income, so about 3.5 million yen annual income.
Okay, so with about 3.5 million yen annual income, wait, so she wants an investment property or a, so, go to the whole question.
Yeah, could she, get started on residential investment? Or get her own house, perhaps?
Yeah, so you can, so similarly, as I discussed earlier, you can borrow about seven times your annual income. So that's, you know, on that kind of salary, maybe you can get like, say, 20 million yen, so 20 million yen. Okay, so you can get a small apartment, either, see, for yourself as a homeowner, as a jutaku loan, it generally needs to be a minimum size. I think for an apartment, at least, like, 30 or 40 square meters is the minimum. Okay, and that's for you to live in as a jutaku loan for home loan conditions. You can also probably borrow about 20 million yen, for an investment loan. But you need to put about 20% deposit. The bank won't give you 100%. I suspect maybe someone, like, that's their, budget, or that's their income, they may not have a year's worth of income just as extra cash to put down as a deposit, about 4 million yen or so. So what might be a good start is an investment property that's, you know, a few million yen, maybe like 7 million yen or so, or 5 million yen. And I don't know if the banks, I know in Tokyo, if you want a place that's, say, 7 million yen out near Tamagawa in, Kanagawa, just across the river, you can probably get financing for that as an investment loan. But you will need to put sort of 20% down. I think the easiest option, a lot of times, is just to buy your own personal property, your personal home. However, yeah, probably for that budget, the home that she wants for herself is not, that may not be really suitable for what she wants. So she needs to assess how much she's really willing to spend. So there are options there, easy to get in, but at the same time, you know, it depends on the individual circumstance. If they want to buy their own personal home, especially if they're single right now, if they're gonna consider a family soon, or maybe, you know, if they're maybe 30 and think, look, in the next 2 to 5 years, I might get married and have a family, this property that you're gonna buy now may hinder your situation in about 5 years' time. So when you want to buy your own family home, so the property that you need to be a bit strategic. Okay, there's a lot more context that you need to understand about the individual, their family situation, marriage situation, how old they are, the stage in life, to give sort of a good answer. So in short, yes, it is possible to purchase a property, but you will need some cash. And it will need to be, I guess, more in Tokyo or within sort of greater Tokyo, where banks will be able to give you just a typical investment loan for it. Investment loans tend to be, you know, 20 to 30% down payments and interest rates around 2 to 3%. Okay, for and probably a rental property under 10 million yen, like just a, you know, 15 or 20 square meter mansion, one room apartment. Around the outskirts of Tokyo, I think is realistic. And you can expect, say, 5% gross rental yield, which will, you know, as you mentioned earlier, maybe it'll be more like 3% net pre-tax yield.
Okay, thanks. So we're not clear the way she maybe phrased it, but if she is looking at investment properties, she doesn't necessarily have to look at a loan. So if she's got enough savings to put a down payment on a loan, the 4 or 5 million that Emil mentioned, or 4 or 5 million will buy her a small cash flow positive investment property, not in Tokyo, obviously, but in other cities. So if loans are challenging, she can still put that money to work and actually buy an investment property for that amount.
Outside of Tokyo.
Outside of Tokyo, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, thanks. One other question at the moment. Someone asked during Matt's presentation, if one is American, I wonder how they handle the taxes of owning a foreign business. Is it a headache to deal with? I imagine it is. And this question, we're not exactly sure what it's referring to, but if we could use it to talk about the fun topic of taxes, I guess. It depends on one's tax residency, but someone asked this during Matt's presentation.
So we've discussed this during one of the questions about the taxation in Japan and the tax treaty between Japan and the USA, but maybe from an American perspective,
it sucks.
It sucks.
It sucks. That's not really my forte, but yeah, as an American citizen, you know, if you've got your own stuff, you're basically double taxed, right? So you need to be aware of that. Talk to an accountant, really, is what you need. They know the stuff. I can only try to remember what it is that they've told me that I should do. So really, that's an accounting question.
Right. Fair enough. Another question came in from Ms. Oakley. Could a single person get a loan for a house, or do they expect you to have a family? And if I just start a new job that pays well, since they don't get salary, do I need to wait 2 years to have that on my record? I guess for the bank or real estate companies. So.
Sure. Yeah, so that's a good question, a very common question. So firstly, no, you don't need to be married for that, so you can get it as a single person or as an individual. However, for the home loan, if you've changed companies, pretty much the minimum term that the bank will require is the probation period that is stated in the contract. The standard is 3 months, some companies do 6 months. So let's say you've been working at a company for 12 years and then you've just changed to a new employer and you want to get a mortgage, you want to buy a house, probably the minimum you need is 3 months wait, otherwise 6 months wait. And the bank will want to see the employment contract and see how long the probation period is. If it's not stated in the contract, it'll be 3 months. Otherwise, it's 3 months or 6 months tend to be the common probation period. And you can apply for a loan after that. Depending on the bank, some will say, look, we can give you the loan, but the way they calculate your borrowing capacity may be slightly reduced. They have a little bit less confidence, or the way they value the...
Because you're single.
No, because you just changed jobs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because you just changed jobs. So the single aspect is irrelevant. Yeah. Rather, it's more just because of the change of job, you now lose stability. Another important thing is, if you just started a new job and it's only been 3 months or 6 months, you need to be there 1 to 2 years. But if you've been currently employed and then you just change jobs, then they'll consider that, and that's when you only need to wait for the probationary period.
Okay. What about for a job, like more a sales, ego type of job, where you don't have a fixed salary, but the salary goes up and down quite a bit?
Yeah, so even that, I look historically, like the past 2 years, what's your salary kind of been? And often even for sales jobs, on the contract it will say, okay, this is your base and your on-target kind of earnings. So often, I get a lot of people in the sales business that are, okay, maybe their income is about, say, 12 to 15 million yen, and the sales on-target earning might be another 4 to 5 million, right? That's kind of what we're looking at. It's not, hey, I'm on zero, and maybe if I make, it's not 100% commission, right? If it is, the banks are gonna be a little bit more hesitant on it. It is more complex. Mm-hmm. They will wanna, and especially if you've only been there for 3 to 6 months, they'll ask, what's your monthly salary? And you wanna see some pay slips. And in that case, if you are, you haven't hit your bonus yet, you haven't received your bonus, then yeah, you probably need to wait 1 or 2 years so you have established 2 years of regular, of clear annual income, and then look at your tax withholding slip in that regard.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so that kind of employment adds a level of complexity to, hey, I've just changed jobs. If you're just a salaried employee, hey, you're earning 7 million a year, sure, we'll wait for the probation period to be over, be it 3 months or 6 months, that's okay. When it's more, non-standard form of payment, it becomes a bit tricky, and the bank has less confidence that you're going to maintain that. They want to see 2 years or so.
Thank you.
questions?
Just circling back to that, like, for business owners. So, say you own your own business and you're talking about the loan is based on the salary you earn, not like what your business earns. What is like the minimum salary that a bank would look at and say, okay, that's great?
3 million yen.
3 million yen. Okay, sorry.
So that 3.5 million yen question was right above that.
Yeah.
So 3 million.
Yeah. I
remember I had.
There was one client who had his wife, and that previous year at Gensen Choshu, your tax withholding state was like 2.99 million. It was like 1万円 off, and they, yeah, sorry, we cannot count her income in the loan. It's really just that. It's a pretty.
Great.
Yeah, check it.
No,
there's a lot of different conditions and personal circumstances, so no, that's not really the case at all. But yeah, like I said, if you have, you know, very specific questions, you like, yeah, send me an email, we can get on, I'll get on a Zoom, and I can ask you sort of all the, you know, get a proper picture of your situation and give you the specific feedback. Otherwise, yeah, there's endless, you know, scenarios, yeah, to talk about.
To stay on the loan subject, is negotiating the rates as a thing in Japan? Can the agent or broker help negotiate the rates down with the banks? And follow-up question still on the loans, about the variable rates, like is there protection? A period of time of protection, like rates going up.
Yeah, okay, very good question. So I get that a bit because I know for my home loans in Australia, every January I call the bank, and try to get, hey, listen, I think the rate's a bit high, other banks are a bit more competitive. I'm considering moving, can I, like, rather move though, I've been with you for a few years, can I get a bit of a discount? No. And they'll do that. In Japan, how much, like 0.5%, like, you know, how much more negotiation room is there? It's kind of, is not, so no, you can't really negotiate it. It's already very, very low. The banks don't make a lot of money. There's no real negotiation room on interest. Unless, you know, if you're with like a bank, like for example, Tsuruba, and you're paying like 4% already, you know, and it wasn't a standard Jutaku loan, then yeah, you can go back every year and maybe negotiate something, but for the most part, for the banks, you cannot. You can, however, refinance. So let's say you locked in a rate that it's a little bit high and things have changed. Maybe at the very beginning, you were possibly a little bit desperate and you went to, you know, accepted something 1.2%. Now you're looking for a residency, you know, more stable employment. A regular SMBC bank can give you a loan for 0.5%. You can just do refinance with a different bank, and they will pay off your existing mortgage. You can't get more money out, but they will pay off your existing mortgage, and you now take up the remaining of the loan goes with the new bank. So yes, that's an option. And in terms of the protection, I think what you're referring to is, well, look, interest rates we hear now are going higher sort of around the world. Let's say I'm at 0.7%. What if it goes up to 2.3%, 2.4%? Are there any safeguards in place? Yes, there are. So one, I personally don't think that will really happen in Japan. It's historically low, and that kind of rate hike will destroy the system. All right, Japan doesn't have that flexibility. We're used to it in the West, right? But they don't really do that here in Japan. But the safeguards that you have in place anyway is if it does go up such that every 5 years, your repayment cannot increase by more than 25%. So if your monthly payment is, say, you know, 200,000 in a month, and like right now, and let's say interest rates go up such that your repayment should actually go up to 300,000 in a month, what they'll say is, look, we're gonna leave it at 200, like the most you can go up is 25%, 250,000 yen per month for 5 years. In that portion, of course, the interest rate is high. A bigger portion of that repayment is interest, and principal is smaller. Okay. So at the end of the period,
of the 35-year loan, you probably have not paid off the full amount of loan, right? Or you may want to do some bonus payments. There may be some residual at the end, but you're not going to get stung all of a sudden. You're expecting 200,000 and now you have to pay 300,000 yen a month. It's going to be protected at 125% increase, so from 200,000 to 250,000 yen a month for 5 years, and then it will go up again another 25%. Only if that's what's required by the outstanding balance. So yes, there are sort of protections in place to protect your cash repayment.
Just a question around structure, so ownership structure. There's been a lot of conversation about as an individual buying your own personal home, but you know, for those interested in investment, are you seeing people holding in their personal as an individual, or are they going and setting up a company?
So again, like Neil was saying about the other question about loans, it's very much a personal, individual scenario. So each and every case could be different. But if we're looking for a general rule of thumb, setting up a company is not a big deal. That's $2,000-$3,000, or you can set up a foreign branch of a Japanese branch of a foreign company, which might be even cheaper. Annual costs, though, are going to be a minimum of, if the company is based in Tokyo, a minimum of about 100,000 yen a year in minimum corporate tax, even if you haven't made any income. And also, your accounting and bookkeeping becomes more complicated, so you need to pay an accountant more. So if our individual customers, for example, pay, say, 100 and 150 bucks per property to an accountant just to get that tax filed, with a company, the minimum that you're going to pay an accountant is going to be 150,000 yen a year, usually more like 200, 250,000 a year. Bookkeeping obviously takes more. You might need to outsource some of the bookkeeping because it becomes there's consumption tax, there might be other things. So, first off, you need your income to justify those annual expenses, because if you've got two or three one-bedroom studios that are making 200 bucks a month, your total annual income is maybe $10,000. Paying $2,000-$3,000 a year in annual upkeep is ridiculous, right? So the first thing you need to make sure is that your income reaches a level where it makes sense to have a corporate structure. You need to look at whether your tax threshold, your tax level as an individual is starting to creep towards the capped corporate tax. That's when it starts making sense. The only other thing to look at is there's more, and obviously I'm not an accountant, so this is all based on very superficial knowledge, but conversation that we had with accountants in conjunction with our customers, there's more that you can claim as a corporate entity in terms of expenses. Perhaps a family member is helping you with bookkeeping, that can become a salary, stuff. There's more that you'll be able to claim. The general rule of thumb that we've seen is if your asset value is not beyond about $500,000 US, which means that conservatively, if you look at a conservative investment in Japan would usually generate somewhere between 4 to 5% net before tax. Beyond that level, it starts to make sense to look at a corporate structure just by virtue of the income and deductibles that you'll be able to claim. But under that, I would say no, unless, and this is where cross-border accounting comes in, unless there's any interest in maybe offsetting income and loss in another country against each other and claiming that there's funds being transferred between the two companies or a company and a branch office, then maybe you have other business interests that make it a viable option. Straight out property investment ownership for somebody who's living and making a salary in Japan, I'd say $500,000 US and over in asset value, probably the benchmark.
Oh, hi, I've got a question about IKEA. I saw it on YouTube, some guy, when they tried to acquire IKEA, they had to deal with the taxes. It's like the previous owner had to settle all their taxes, like the inheritance taxes, before they can acquire the IKEA. Normally, does the buyer actually settle that, or does it require the seller to settle that first?
Either can happen. Usually it's the buyer. That being said, we generally just avoid that situation. Because it's undesirable. So the simple solution to that problem is don't do it.
It's more outstanding property taxes, I think, usually, right? More inheritance taxes.
Oh, was that about inheritance
taxes? I think it was about inheritance taxes.
It's general taxes.
Yeah, usually it's property. Inheritance can play into that, but usually it's just the property that they're...
There's enough to choose from.
Yeah.
There's enough to choose from, you don't have to. Yeah, you just pick the next one.
Yeah, Alex, maybe circling back to this side.
Oh, sorry.
Let me just do Daniels and then
Mark.
This is a short-term rental one. I don't know who's going to be... When I looked at it in the past, and tried to cost things up, I would look at the cleaning, outsourcing that to a local agency. I see there's quite a few users that do that now. So I was really surprised at the high cost relative to the nightly income. Is that something that you pass off to the guests, or you like, cover it yourself?
Traditionally, in the past, yes. There's going to be some changes afoot at the moment. I think, especially as in the US, there's been a bill passed which is like the junk fees, because it was, you know, getting to a ridiculous level that there would be a management fee and a cleaning fee and a linen fee and a resort fee and a taxes, and that was just all really racking up the fees, and so there was a big backlash in the media, and so what Airbnb have done is basically tweak their algorithm so that if you have a ton of fees on your listing, then you don't get shown to as many people. So there's a lot of, like I said before, revenue management and pricing policy is not a passive thing. It's not just set and forget. There's a lot of tweaking you can do. So if you build in the price of the cleaning into the nightly rate, and you will go up in the search results on the OTAs. But that said, what I tend to do is I do have a set fee, and I do that as a pass through on my books. So that's not a profit center for me. So I just pass that straight through to my team. I don't outsource my cleaning. I hire my own staff, and that way I have a lot more control over the quality and the availability. That's cheaper than outsourcing to a company. Yeah.
I'm looking at moving to Japan permanently and establishing residency in some Inaka area, and I'm wondering if it's better to establish a visa before making a home purchase, or if it's okay to purchase a home first.
Yeah,
that's a question.
I don't think Akia maybe doesn't come into it. From a visa perspective, there's no limitations on foreign ownership of property in Japan. The advantages are, obviously, if you're here, speak the language, can go attend meetings in person, sign documents in person, then you don't need someone like us, right? You might need us as consultants along the way, but you don't need us to do everything on your behalf. But that's just the only logistics practical. Visa-wise, there's no limitation, there's no tax difference. You're actually exempt from local municipal taxes if you don't live here, so.
Okay, and then one other question is, I know that there was I saw there were government incentives for Inaka areas. Can you speak about any of those?
These are easy questions. They're by and large a huge pain, and they also don't pay out very well, and they're also very slow. So while they exist, and they change from, there's how many municipalities in Japan? Like 1,500, 1,700, something like that. They're idiosyncratic across the board, so there's no kind of boilerplate. So number one, you need to determine where you want to go and see what incentives that they do have, and then you need to see what kind of red tape that you need to go through. By that point, you're probably already 3 months or so into the process and you haven't gotten anywhere. So usually, again, I mean, it's unfortunate that, incentives sound nice, but the fact is, even just peel back one layer of that onion, and you'll soon realize that maybe, I wouldn't call them rotten, but they certainly aren't well thought out. And really, most of the time, are just kind of, they're incentives to pull your hair out and not to, actually do anything productive. I'm very outspoken about this stuff, too. So, yeah, it's a problem. I mean, You know, you've seen, especially, I was really happy to be, if I can run with your question for a little minute, or a little bit. Like, at the beginning of this year, there was like four or five, at least, different articles across different publications that were coming out railing against the government for its million yen per child policy, which I agree with. I think a lot of those articles were kind of black and white, so there was more nuance that I would have wanted for it. But the fact is, like, these initiatives, they sound nice, but at the end of the day, they're kind of false hope is what they are. And they tell people that, oh my gosh, you know, if you do this thing, then we'll help you out. But yeah, okay, technically speaking, you're helping me out, but I mean, it's kind of like 0.05%, you know, that number of hope that you're getting, which really, again, the juice is not really worth the squeeze on it. If you've got the cash or you already have the support systems or somehow you're able to go about it in an independent manner, generally speaking, that's more efficient, it's faster, it can be cheaper. I mean, of course, there are always exceptions to the rule, but everything that I've seen suggests that all these government incentives don't actually accomplish really anything.
So you say pick your property, or pick your area, pick your property, and then see if there's anything you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't count on it.
Yeah.
Don't make a decision based on it.
There was one place in, it was in Shizuoka, Omaegasaki, that had, you know, one of the free akiya that you had to pledge, you know, I'm going to live there for 5 years. And I mean, there were various caveats that were associated with it, but I did run through, like I physically went to the property itself, definitely a fixer-upper, but not in that terrible condition. As a proper location, certainly wasn't, I mean, there was a nice view of Mount Fuji, but, you know, like, definitely not near any local access points. I don't know if that's a good example, but it's far from... Oh, it was one of the free houses? Like,
it was an actual free house.
Yeah. It was actually two separate houses. One was kind of a large, craft space sort of thing, and then another one was an actual house. So they were kind of billing it as, you know, you can start a business and a family here, which, again, technically is kind of true, but so far it's like, oh boy, that's where I want to do that. I don't know anybody who would have said that. So, yeah, don't count on it. It is possible, but let your heart be the guide. And then see if there's any other support systems that you can access.
Another home loan question. With the rates being so low, are there any times when it's beneficial to pay them off sooner than the full terms?
So my general thought on early repayment or even putting down a deposit unnecessarily, like the Atamakin, I think is not really a good idea. How I look at it is, if your interest rate for your mortgage is, you know, 0.5%, and any amount you contribute to that in an early repayment is essentially saving you 0.5%. So 0.5% is the return you're getting on your early repayment. And it's locked in there for the remainder of the loan. Okay, you can't get it out unless you sell the property. If you think about that in investment terms, would you put any cash into a fixed 30-year, 35-year term loan that's only going to give you back 0.5%. It doesn't sound attractive at all. That's why I actually think those 100% or 105% loans, the loans with closing costs, are a good deal. Try to get as much as you can at these really, really low interest rates, because they are very unique. They are only available because it's a personal home loan. If you try to do an investment loan, you can't get it. If you try to get a car loan, a credit card loan, anything else, you cannot get it. So it is the cheapest money you'll ever come across. It has life insurance included with it, okay? And yeah, so your money's better anywhere else, except the Japanese bank. But don't put it in there.
Like, if you got
okay.
money off,
like if you have enough money to pay off your loan, instead of paying off the home loan at 0.5%, why don't you put it into something that would generate at least 3 or 4%, for example, right? That just makes more financial sense.
Yeah. And Just as a follow-up, any recommendations for them picking between fixed and variable interest rates?
So that one, again, I think is a bit personal preference. My understanding is that economists have kind of forecast, look, over the next, 35 years, the average on the loan will be, be it a 10-year, 20-year, or 35-year full-term fixed forecast, their net profit at the end of it should be the same. So if they say, look, the 10-year fixed loan is going to be, 1.2%, it means they're expecting that the average over the next 10 years, even on variable, will be about that much, okay? So by you deciding what fixed term, like whether to choose option A or option B, is kind of going against the judgment of the you're trying to sort of outplay the bank's economists. What I feel is a better option is think, do you want stability and a fixed loan payment now moving forward, so you have some certainty about what you're going to do? This is more relevant to people that are, 40, in their 40s and 50s, that want to understand moving forward for the next, two decades, three decades, what their payments are going to be, because often once you reach your 50s, they say that's kind of the peak of your earning capacity. Whereas, if you're a younger family, for example, in your early 30s, for example, you probably want a bit more cash flow now. So you want the lower interest rates now, so you have a bit more cash because your kids are going to school, right? You may want to go on some vacation, you've got the other expenses. And then in 20 years' time, when they're at school, or sorry, when they're out of the house, right, the kids are out of the house, hopefully you're earning more, so you can actually handle the additional interest repayments, and you have less fees. You're not paying for your kids anymore. They're already out of the house. So it's more of a bit of a lifestyle choice. One thing I do want to say as well, though, that's important with Japanese loans is the actual interest rate, the bank interest rate is variable, is about 2.45%. The 0.5%, 0.7% is a discounted rate. And often that's discounted. They say, well, we'll give you this is the store rate, the temporal rate, but the discounted rate would be 1.9% discount. So you get it for 0.5%. However, if you choose a fixed rate, a 10-year fixed rate, at the end of that 10-year, you need to check, are you still going to get the currently promoted 1.9% discount or just a 1% discount? Because a lot of banks is, at the end of the 10-year fixed, they're going to give you, 2.4% minus the standard 1% discount, not the 1.9% that they're currently promoting. Okay, which is why, personally, I think the variable rates right now, with Japanese banks, is very special, super low, and you can only get that low rate at the loan outset. If you go from 3-year fixed back to variable, guess what? It's going to be a 1.4% rate. It's not going to be the 0.5%. So that's my take on it. And if you don't know what to do, what's quite common as well is 50% variable, 50% fixed for the life of the loan. Then you're kind of covered.
I have two questions. One on the short-term state. If you buy a property to rent out and you have a company manage it for you, do you still have to be licensed yourself?
There are two licenses involved. The actual property is licensed if you're getting a Minpaku license. And it's the house that is licensed, not necessarily, the owner is listed on the license, but it's their house that actually has the license. But to get the Minpaku license, you also have to have a contract with a licensed Minpaku kanri. And typically a Minpaku kanri, even if they do nothing for you, if they just have their name on that document, they will take a percentage of all the revenue. Because Japan likes to have those layers of deniability. So someone has to be responsible. And so, if a guest is unruly and someone complains, then the government wants someone to point the finger at, and that's the kundi. And so the kundi will take, you know, because it's a risk. If you're not managing the property well and you get, you know, the house burns down or the neighbours complain, the kundi isn't liable. So that's why they take a fee. Often the kundi will also be the management company as well. So the reason I have both types of licences is that I didn't want to pay somebody else. I wanted to have the whole vertical, you know, I didn't want to pay 20% to someone when I was doing all the management anyway. I rarely sponsor other people's licences unless I'm actually doing the management. But there are some people, and that's all they do, is they live off the income from other people's work. So, yeah, it's not my business model.
This is, by the way, just to confirm for me, this is different if you're actually living in the property and renting out rooms in your house, right? Then you don't need to be licensed. I mean, the property needs to be licensed.
I used to have a bunch of Airbnb properties. Yeah, so if you're, you know, if you want to do room share, like say it's your house, you have a 3-bedroom, and you want to rent out 2 of the rooms, you have to register the property, license the property, but you don't need a management company. You yourself be the manager because you live on premise. The Airbnb or short term, like under 1 month, under 28 day stays. However, the rules say like if you can go to work and come back, but if you go on long, like on holidays or business trips and you're out of the house for like, you know, several days or a week or 2 weeks, then you need to have a management company in place. Because if the regulation is, what if the guests get stuck, you know, a lost foreigner in Japan, who's looking after this tourist? And if you're on a business trip, then there's no one looking after them. So yeah, they're a bit stricter than us.
Okay. Thank you. And the other question is around kind of legal ownership. So if myself and my wife is not working right now, so under the assessment of the home loan, it would just be on my income. But in terms of registered ownership on the property, would that only be allowed to be under my name, or could it be under both? Or how could it work?
So you can actually put it under, like when you register the property, the title, the scrivener will say, okay, what's the percentage? And you can decide, you know, 50-50, you know, like how they do in Japan, like nibu no ichi, two, like, you know, so one half, two-fifths or three-fifths, you know, someone gets three-fifths, someone gets two-fifths, that's how it's often recorded, and you can do any kind of number you want. So you are able to do that, even if it's all in your name. One thing to keep in mind, though, is when you do the, I believe there is kind of like a bit of a gift tax that they may consider, you bought the house, you're paying for it, but half of it is given to your spouse. Like straight off the bat, she's got half ownership. So I don't know how that gets assessed. If you can say that she's paying part of the loan as well, then that's easier. But straight up, I don't know how that is assessed. You need to speak to an accountant about that. But just something to keep in mind. Like one of the questions, and the other thing is, I talked about the tax rebate. The tax rebate you get is for having a loan on a property, and if you only own half the property, they'll say, okay, you have this much loan, but you only own half the property, so only half of this value is going to be given for the tax rebate. So you need to, again, speak with the local tax authority about how that is calculated. Generally, the situations I've had is both the husband and wife will get a joint loan. Again, they'll combine their salaries, right, and get a joint loan. They're both included on the mortgage, and then they split 50-50. And that's kind of beneficial because usually the tax break caps out at about the loan at about 40 or 50 million yen. A lot of my clients buy properties like around the 1 oku mark. So when you're at 1 oku, if you do 50-50 ownership, then the loan, the bank was out there, and you're both on the loan. When you get the loan together, the bank doesn't actually specify
who has how much of the loan. Also, you know, you and your wife have together the joint loan of 100 million yen. And then the tax office, when you want to do the tax rebate, will say, okay, well, land ownership, building owner, property ownership is 50-50. So we're going to assess the liability of the mortgage 50-50. So now you each have a 50 million yen loan. So you can both apply for that tax rebate and get like the 350,000 yen each. Okay, so you get double the tax rebate is part of the strategy. So again, something to, as we were saying before, I think with some of the question before from the lady about the benefits that the government give you when you are, you know, the handouts or whatnot, go with your heart. Think of what, find the place that's right for you. Don't let the benefit really decide what your decision, because the benefit I think is quite not significant enough to make such a huge change in your decision. It's a nice bonus to have. But at the end of the day, you know, find the property you like best, do what is, don't forcibly put your wife or try to get a bank loan that the that your wife is on it unnecessarily just to try to get a tax rebate, because at the end of the day, the rebates are not worth the inconvenience you'll have to suffer.
My question is more on property management problem. Let's say, for example, you own a property, then you have a tenant, and also this tenant of yours create his own or her business by renting your property to other people. Have you encountered this problem, and how do you deal with it?
So usually we find out that this happens because neighbors in Japan are very nosy and they're very used to things being smooth and quiet. So as soon as somebody's running a business out of a property, whether it's a hair salon, a massage parlor, or they're just Airbnb-ing it without permission, we will find out because the kumiai, the owner union, will contact us and say that neighbors have complained about A, B, and C. It depends on what you want to do as a landlord. Again, in Japan, it's not difficult to kick a tenant out. It usually just involves sending them a letter and saying that they need to move. So what we normally do is we give them maybe, obviously depending on the level of disturbance, if they're burning the neighbor's house down, then we're gonna kick them out. But otherwise, we would give them a warning, but usually just one, and then we would just politely ask them to leave. They don't really have a leg to stand on because they violated the terms of the tenancy lease if they've done that. So it's not a huge issue in Japan.
This question is from Ziv. You showed us a few properties when you were going through the sites, and anything worth investing in yield-wise seemed to have certain characteristics, like they were 20 years old or more, and so on. And you also said that, you know, such mansions will tend not to appreciate in value, and you cannot raise the rent as well. So what's the exit strategy then when you get into an investment like this?
Yeah, so first off, it's really important to understand that Japan is a huge market. It's the second market, second only to the USA, both size-wise, asset value-wise, and transaction volume-wise. So it's a very, very, very liquid market. When properties are priced correctly, they sell, and the reason we only found six properties when we're searching for individual units is because they sell very, very quickly, and as long as, you know, the price is reasonable. So for our customers specifically, if the property is still attractive, we would try to sell it to another customer who's maybe looking for something similar. But otherwise, we advertise it on the market, and if the price is correct, it's usually spoken for within a month or two at most. If it's a building, maybe 3-4 months, but usually not beyond that. But this pricing it correctly thing is where it lies. So the properties don't, the structures don't appreciate, but properties, location-wise, do appreciate. So a particular location, for example, in central Tokyo, central Fukuoka, that was generating 5 or 6% return will still be attractive 10 years later, even if it's generating only 3 or 4% return, because that area has gone up in value and investors are not expecting to make 5 or 6% anymore, right? So you could potentially sell at a profit. Other locations, you know, building fees have gone up, rent hasn't gone up, or maybe you are getting higher rent because a tenant moved in in 1995, then they moved out, now the rent is half that amount. You're not going to be able to sell that property at the same price that you bought it anymore, because investment properties are evaluated based on the yield that they generate. So it's not so much common market dynamics in that particular area, it's more a case of investors, like we as investors, they look at the bottom line, they see that it's generating 4 or 5%, and they decide if that's attractive in that area and if there's anything better that they can put their money into or not. But if it's priced properly, usually all we need to do is contact one of our agent partners and will disappear within a month or two.
Sorry guys, my question is about some of the risks associated, in particular earthquake and earthquake insurance. I've heard stories that it's pretty hard to get anything out of the insurance unless the damage is really obvious. is really obvious. The situations where you've got multiple properties or you're owning a small apartment building that becomes uninhabitable and you have obviously an outstanding loan on that property. What's your experience with the insurance on those situations?
So we're a little bit spoiled in that regard just because of the amount of properties that we deal with that we've been channeling to the same insurance company for over 11 years. So we get very good terms. So everything that I'm about to say now is maybe different in somebody else's experience. We haven't had any issues with insurance claims. There's been a slight revamp in insurance regulations late last year, I think from October. So terms are a bit more strict now. They require a bit more proof about the damages and they've reduced the amount that they'll compensate you for. But there's still, we've never had an insurance claim refused yet. Having said that, that could be because we're good business for them and they're just, you know, they're happy to keep us. For example, earthquake damages or weather damages or accidental damages are actually not the major source of insurance compensation that we are asking for. We usually claiming because a tenant has died in the property, right? So Japan has a very, generally speaking, aging population, and I can safely say that about 5% of our tenants actually die in the property. Right? It just happens. So we submit an application, the insurance company reviews the renovation estimate. All we need is the police report saying that a body was found in the property, and then we're covered. I mean, we haven't had to argue with an insurance company in Japan to date. That's over 11 years, about 200 and something properties that we facilitated. But it could be that other people have different experiences, and then maybe on the home insurance market.
Yeah. So I can't speak to that point. Experience of really any claims that, like, after we sell the property, we don't go to that level. And we haven't had an earthquake really, like, damage. I don't have any experience with that to give a proper answer. However, I do know that, you know, in terms of the level of damage that happens to a property, like, when in an earthquake policy, they say, okay, based on the city, like, the ward's assessment of your damage, is it a tier 1, tier 2, or tier 3 damage level? That is what the insurance will pay out on. So not based on, you know, to say, oh, there's lots of damage and the insurance is not paying out. No, the insurance will pay out depending on the tier of damage that is assessed by the ward. It's not just up to you to decide. And that's my understanding of the policy. I haven't actually seen it in play. And I actually suspect if the city hall has said, this is a tier 2 damage, then the insurance will pay out according to the tier 2. Because, you know, in Japan, everything is follows the process, okay? So if you had a documentation for that, that is what you'll pay out accordingly.
But it is pretty reliable,
Whether or not it's reliable, I don't know because it hasn't happened, but I do know that's the process for them in terms of how much they pay out for a earthquake damage. And one thing to keep in mind, when we get the homeowner, I think I mentioned it, that's costing like anywhere from 60 to 100,000 yen per year for a house. If the house is, earthquake coverage covers 50% of what the regular damage does because, so for example, if the house is...
The official EVAC.
Sorry?
Of the official evaluation, which could be different to market.
No, of the policy. So when you get the policy, if you say that this house is worth 20 million yen, the rebuild value is 20 million yen. So if there's a fire, you can get paid out 20 million yen for the rebuild of the property. If there's an earthquake only covers 50% of that. So the earthquake in the policy will say earthquake loan item is 10 million yen, not 20. So if there's a total
assessed from the ward, no longer livable, needs to be torn down, then the earthquake policy will only cover 10 million yen of that.
If it's not complete damage and you have a good policy, good insurance policy, there are actually specialists that will come and they work for you, not for the insurance company, and then they will submit the claim on your behalf to your insurance company. They specialize on that, so they will come to your house and they will basically inspect all your tears and damages. And then, because they work for you, not for the insurance company, they will, I would say, slightly exaggerate the damage, and then they get you some claim, because the general issue in Japan is that people actually do not really claim that much damage because it's too much hassle, or
that's
they don't
so
know
cheap.
How.
That's why it's so
yeah,
cheap.
They don't know how, they don't want to deal with it. So those damages are usually kind of forgotten. So you can, if you have a property and you think that the damage is there and you don't know how to go around it, you can actually hire a specialist that will come and they will do it for you after they read your insurance policy. So it's everything is doable if you know how and if you are actually willing to go for it.
I'll add one more thing, sorry.
On the insurance front as well, there's sometimes, for example, so like Emil was saying, earthquake, it covers you up to 50% of the value of the property in case of a total loss. But for example, third-party damages are covered 100% always. So if you had, you know, your boiler exploded, you leaked water into three properties under you, and it also caused damage to your property, insurance will cover 100% of what was done to the properties below you and 0% to you, because it's just normal wear and tear and it's not even covered. Renovation companies, property managers are very adept at getting an estimate that puts more of the damage on the third party, for example. It's kind of like creative accounting. They just know what to do to make sure that you get better compensation. So it's good to ask their opinion about it.
We still have a question from Daniel.
I'm curious if anybody on the team has experience with property development, as in buying an empty plot of land or scraping in an existing house and then building a new structure and then selling that new structure immediately, and then kind of what's the profit margins for that sort of a...
We did investment property for ourselves, because that's kind of part of the business that we do. And we used our own land, because we bought a house with basically five plots, or like five properties could build on it, and then used what I used to use as a tomato farm to build a house on it. And but we were kind of we had two options, and we ended up going with rental instead of selling. But we had it at first. We had it assessed, and then whichever one came first, either offered to buy or offered to rent, and then we ended up going with the rent. So we didn't calculate the price of the, or we didn't count the price for the land, because it was our land. And then we did the build. We built with pullers. So just kind of a basic house, two floors plus a loft, and we could have sold it for more than a double. So we would make about 150% of what the construction actually cost us. So basically, we spent 15 million or so on building the place, and then we could have sell it for about 38-40. So it depends. If you have your own land, it's profitable, but then if you sell it kind of quickly, you have to pay more. If you sell it, I think below 3 or 5 years after you built it, your taxes, yeah. Your taxes are higher, so you know, when you're renting it and then you sell it later on down the line, or you don't sell it at all, it's different. So we did not sell right now, but we built it, and because we own the land is fairly small, as I'm saying, it was my tomato farm. It kind of got the value up.
very much, and you can make a good profit out of that, especially if you find a good land.
I did want to add the thing about the taxation. So one reason individuals don't flip in Japan, like, you know, in Australia and in the US, definitely everyone does the flips. We don't buy and resell is because the capital gains tax, if you hold under 5 years, it's about 40%, that's it, roughly.
It goes from 40% to 20% after 5 years.
Yeah, so you, like, if you build something and then sell it, you make 10 million yen, 20 million yen, 40% goes to tax right away. And you're probably not going to hold it for 5 years. You know, that's not really a flip. That is a long-term hold. So in Australia, long-term capital gain is up to 12 months. In Japan, it's 5 years. So it's not really a, you know, even with mansions around Tokyo, individuals don't get an old place and renovate it and fix it up just to flip. Renovation companies, reform companies, will buy it themselves. Like, they're in the flipping game. When it's a renovation company that does it, like, that's their business. The tax office treats any capital gain, the profit they make, as just typical revenue, not capital gain. So they are just taxed as regular business income.
Yeah.
If they've made 20 million yen on a flip, that's just 20 million yen of revenue, and whatever expenses you have, that's ordinary taxation on business revenue. Whereas, as an individual, if we do that, it's a capital gain, 40%, which is quite high.
If I may go back, when we do it as a company, we usually look for kind of rundown properties that nobody really wants and that are like total damage. And then we buy them really, really cheap and then use our company employees, our artisans, to fix it. We record it for marketing purposes. Then we use that as a case study for our promotions where we actually show what we can do with that kind of property. And then we either rent it or flip it, but that's a business side, not a private part. So depending on how you do it.
Yeah, just to sum it up, so what Blanca was explaining is her potential, she didn't sell, but she said she could get 150%. That's roughly what I've been hearing from developer friends and colleagues in Japan, is you roughly can expect something like 20% profit, but it depends on how long it took you to build and sell, whether it's going to be profitable or not. So if it's 20% over 5 years, it's maybe less attractive than if you could get it in 2 years and be done with it.
Anything from the stream? I just don't want to abandon the streamers if they have questions.
I get one last question from the stream. Dorian Black asks, best bank to serve foreigners, English speaking, for giving loans. He has heard of SMBC, Shinsei, any others?
SMBC I think is referring to Prestia. So Prestia and Shinsei are the big ones that will do documentation in English. So they are the best ones to serve if you need English, and the deals are fine, the interest rates are fine, but one of the issues is they take a long time to get the approval, and when you are sort of find a property that you really like and you're keen to sort of jump on it, and you need that pre-approval, a Japanese bank, we can get it in 48 hours. With SMBC, with Shinsei or Prestia, it's 2 weeks, and there's a lot of anxiety, and you may lose that property because another client has come back with a pre-approval. He's able to jump straight through. Yeah, we have someone who's laughing in the crowd because they've experienced that themselves.
Thank you.
Right. I think we're done. Yeah.
Is this fun? Is this fun? Okay, thank you very
much. Just look, thank you to all the panel. Thank you to everyone for coming. I'm surprised how many people actually stayed throughout the whole time.
Yeah, I was expecting to have nobody here.
How many people are on the Zoom now? 10, 12?
13.
Oh, okay, yeah. Fantastic. So, look, so thank you everyone for coming and bearing with us this entire time. I do hope that you found it useful. We do try to share as much information as we can. One, it's our business, but two, as you can tell, we're also quite passionate about helping people. That's what we try to do.
And about property.
And about property.
just sign up to the podcast if you want. If you want to know the voice of us.
Yeah, we need
content.
Yeah.
We need content on the podcast. Yes.
Although I think we, like, I know a few of us have been discussing. Maybe we'll do this like twice a year. I don't know how updated the content will be. It's kind of a similar thing, so I don't expect I'll see all the same faces. But I do hope lots of people like reach out if you want to, you know, buy a place, renovate, invest, short-term stay, or go live out the bush. You have someone to reach out to. Look, thank you once again. To everyone up here and to everyone in the audience, both in person and in Zoom. Thank you. You guys have been fantastic. Oh yeah.